If it's so bad, why don't you just leave already? Let me ask you a question. Did you kind of cringe when I said that? Have you heard that question one time too many from people in your life? My guess is that if you did say yes to those two questions, you might be familiar with what it feels like to walk on eggshells all the time. That means you're probably in a toxic relationship, maybe with a narcissist.
Have you found yourself dealing with a narcissist or a toxic person who actively tore down your self-esteem or devalued you in some way? Did you find yourself struggling with anxiety and feeling just not good enough? Maybe even rejected? If so, you're gonna wanna stick around because today at queenbeing.com, I'm gonna explain to you exactly why you feel this way and how it relates to your relationships with narcissists.
More and more people tell me that they find themselves missing their narcissist even when they're the ones who left. They keep falling back into the relationship. They keep giving and giving and giving. One more chance, one more chance. When does it end? And why is it so hard to get over a narcissist?
So why is it so hard for us to leave a narcissist if we already know for sure that that person is toxic to us?
With maybe a few exceptions, most people who have been in a relationship with a narcissist find it really difficult to just totally let go of that person. Like I said, whether you left the narcissist or they left you, this seems to be a consistent issue for people who have been in these relationships. I personally understand it because even in my own situation, I found recovery very difficult and I slipped back in once or twice in the process. Even though I was no longer really connected to that person emotionally, I still felt that I was somehow, and I kept finding myself talking to him and going back and trying to deal with him repeatedly, and it turned out to be very unhealthy for me.
We probably feel we're not really even in love with that person anymore, or we don't care about that person in the way that we used to. What keeps us stuck?
How can you get past your narcissist? How can you wake up one day and go, I didn't think about that person all day yesterday.
Maybe it has to do with the kids. Maybe it has to do with the house. Maybe it doesn't have anything to do with any of those things. Maybe there's more to it than we think.
One thing to consider when we're talking about recovering from a relationship with a narcissist is how the relationship ended. So whether you initiated the breakup or they did, and all of the things that come with that. If you initiated the breakup, you might be struggling with guilt and wondering, did you make the right choice? You doubt yourself because the narcissist has taught you to do that over the years. If you were broken up with, then you're left spinning and you don't even know what to think. You might not even have realized they were a narcissist until after the fact.
When you're in a relationship with a narcissist or a toxic person of any sort, a lot of times it looks really perfect on the outside. People who aren't involved intimately and directly don't usually recognize how bad things are behind closed doors. And if you're anything like I was, you probably don't want anyone else to recognize it either. You probably kind of helped to keep that mask on pretty firmly, or at least you used to. But if you do manage to talk to someone outside the relationship about the relationship, chances are that someone has said to you at some point or another, if it's so bad, why don't you just leave already? Or some version of that. Am I right? And maybe more times than you care to admit. But what these generally well-meaning people don't recognize is how very, very complicated life can be when you're dealing with a narcissist.
On top of that, the trauma bonding factor makes it feel like you're going through painful withdrawal, not unlike the kind of withdrawal experienced by heavy drug addicts. There's a reason for that. The same area of your brain is affected.
It is basically what happens as a result of ongoing cycles of abuse, thanks to a narcissist in this case. During the abuse cycle, you go through intermittent different kinds of reinforcement. So you either get a reward when you do with a narcissist once, or you get a punishment when you don't, just like a dog. What happens is that this cycle of reward and punishment creates extremely powerful emotional bonds between the two of you, and that makes it difficult for you to even think about change.
It's complicated and convoluted to say the very least. When you love a narcissist, chances are that you're already mentally exhausted. Sometimes the idea of anyone else adding any more problems to your plate makes you physically ill. As a result of that, you might find yourself becoming increasingly isolated in some sort of attempt to maintain your sanity. In fact, in some cases, just the simple act of engaging with normal people will leave you feeling exhausted. It will leave you feeling scared, and very often it kind of makes you want to run and hide.
Of course, why the relationship ended, whether you left or they left, also matters when we're talking about how to get through it. It's one thing if you kind of went one way and your partner went the other, or if you suddenly realized, oh my gosh, this person is abusing me, I gotta go. But it's a whole other ball of wax if we're talking about you found out you got cheated on or something terrible happened that gave you the catalyst that you needed to kind of step out of that relationship. Well, then the other thing is if your partner turns out to have been some sort of an addict, like a drug or alcohol addict or something else, this can also cause the marriage to end or a relationship to end, and that leads to other issues. Now, if we're talking about a family member or a friend who you've had to go no contact with, other issues might be involved. Whether you went no contact or they did, either way, you're still probably struggling with similar feelings.
Of course, we all know that narcissists tend to like the isolation factor, and they want to encourage you to become further isolated. They'll do anything in their power to make you feel more isolated, and that's partially because they want all of your attention, partially because they don't want you to have anyone outside of them who supports you emotionally or otherwise, because then it's a lot harder for you to leave. They want you to be dependent on them in some way, or always, financially, emotionally, physically, and otherwise. Now, in some cases, they are financially, emotionally, and physically dependent on you, but they do other things to keep you in your place. They gaslight you, they manipulate you. Their intent is to leave you helpless with the level of psychological abuse that they put out there. They want to keep you stuck. They need you to be stuck because if you recognize, oh my goodness, I could do better, and you leave them, what are they left with? This is another reason that they tend to tear you down emotionally and why they work so hard to destroy your self-esteem. And of course, while you understand that your friends and your family members mean well when they reach out to you, if you have spoken to them about this, and you know they mean well when they ask you that dreaded question, why haven't you just left already? What they don't know is that it can seriously affect yourself and your life.
Trauma bonds happen in any toxic relationship. They tend to be kind of strengthened by inconsistent positive reinforcement or intermittent reinforcement. So what that means is that mostly things were difficult. Mostly things weren't great, but every now and then something awesome would happen, or the narcissist would do something that would make you feel kind of good, kind of warm and fuzzy inside. And in an effort to obtain that again, you would stay around in the relationship. In the beginning, it probably happened more often than not. And as time went on, the positive reinforcement most likely became further spaced out. So less of it per negative incident. One reason that recovering from a narcissist is so difficult is because the narcissist by nature does the push and pull thing. Do you know what I'm talking about? That's when the narcissist will desperately want you one second and then the next second push you away. And it seems like the moment that they have you, you know, if they say, oh my God, I can't live without you, I don't know what I'm going to do, and you give in and you go, okay, let's stay together. Within minutes, sometimes they're back on the same old abusive track. So they want you, they get you, they push you away. It's an ongoing cycle. You make excuses for this person to your family and your friends and even yourself. You try to minimize it or explain it away, and you believe it for a moment that maybe they really won't do that again. And when they do it again, you make more excuses.
You probably have already forgotten that you're good enough if you're still stuck in one of these relationships. And even if you know it logically, some little part of yourself probably doesn't agree with that, probably doubts it at the very least. And a lot of times your friends and your family will become frustrated and fed up with you when you don't just walk away from the narcissist. And then they kind of step back from you emotionally. And that kind of leaves you even more isolated. You have no choice but to let them walk away because you're so exhausted already and you don't even have the energy to explain it to them anymore. Then, of course, your abuser gets exactly what they're going for. You, more isolated and under the narcissist's control. You, of course, then are more trapped than ever.
Being with a narcissist, you go through the love bombing phase, then you go through the devalue phase and the discard phase, and then it circles right back around to love bombing or hoovering, depending on whether or not they actually discarded you or they just mentally and emotionally discarded you and stayed in the relationship. Because of their typical cycle, they tend to want to kind of re-insinuate themselves back into your life. They want to send you a crazy text message, or they want to drive by your house, or they want to call you for something that is completely unrelated to anything. Did you get the dog shots this month or whatever? And they kind of keep themselves in your life. Part of that reason for that is they want to have you as backup supply just in case whatever they're on right now doesn't work out. Part of it is to have control.
The fact is that our brains work against us here. We become involved in relationships that cause us serious harm because our brain chemistry sort of creates that false sense of connection thanks to the dysregulation that happens because of the abuse.
I want you to remember that trauma bonding is essentially being loyal to someone who has destroyed you or who is actively destroying you. So that is not good. It's not healthy.
Some people say it's like a heroin addiction. So since the relationship seems so promising at the beginning and as you stick through it, you know, it promises all these amazing things. But apparently heroin also promises an amazing high. The thing is, while both of those kind of give a feeling of utopia, at least for a brief period of time, they also sort of suck your soul out, you know, in the process. First start using drugs or drinking alcohol, You get that elated feeling. You feel all, where has this been all my life? Well, the same kind of thing happens in a relationship. And at the beginning, whether it's healthy or not, you will find yourself feeling just like that. But then what happens is that as the thrill of the newness wears off, you start to think you need the other person just to breathe, just to survive. It becomes a psychological dependence. We can literally become addicted to a person just like we can become addicted to food, alcohol, or drugs. What it all boils down to is that it's sort of a way of letting go of our personal responsibility for our own feelings. It's almost a way that we kind of abandon ourselves a little bit as individuals.
So why does it bother us so much when they ask us why we stay? To be honest, it's probably one of the most upsetting and annoying questions anyone could ask you when you're in the thick of that narcissistic relationship. So why does it bother us? Why can't we just tell them the truth? For one thing, I don't think we always know the truth. But the truth is that they don't really recognize how complicated and how overwhelming it would be for us to actually try to leave when we're stuck in the middle of that situation. Plus, we know the narcissist is going to make it very hard for us to leave. They'll make it as difficult as they possibly can. And of course, since long ago, the narcissist made sure that we didn't have any friends or family members to support us, or at least that they pushed them as far away as they possibly could, well, that keeps us stuck too, doesn't it? The more your narcissistic abuser controls your life, the more you feel stuck in a sort of spider web of control. And often, we don't even see it happening while it's happening. It's very subtle. Bit by bit, they tinker away on your personal boundaries, repeatedly and systematically crossing them one by one. Before you know it, you're in the middle of your worst nightmare, and you can't tell anyone about it because you're so damn humiliated. Because you know better. Because you're smarter than this. Because honestly, don't want anyone to see how weak you've become. And somewhere in your mind, you focus on the good stuff because you know it's right around the corner. You know that love bombing is coming. It's part of the ups and downs. It's part of that roller coaster ride that a narcissistic relationship gives us. And it's part of why we become addicted. It's trauma bonding that keeps us stuck. All of these things plus trauma bonding. I want you to know something. This is not normal. No matter how much the narcissist claims this is normal, this is not normal. Despite the crap you've been fed, the way this person is behaving is not normal. In fact, if your relationship with a narcissist were a mental disorder, it would look sort of like bipolar disorder, the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. The most intense pleasure and the most profound pain, exhaustion and exhilaration, the happiest you've ever been and wishing you were dead, alternatively, often all in the same day.
Do narcissists get jealous? Well, do they? Sure they do. But do they get jealous when they've moved on and then they find out you're dating someone else? Yeah, a lot of times they do. Why do they do that? Because they see you as a possession. It's not because they're like, oh, I messed up. I lost the best thing that ever happened to me. It's because they're like, oh, that kid took my toy. It's the same concept as a kid stealing a toy. As in, the narcissist sees you as an extension of him or herself and nothing more. They see you as an object to entertain them and to make them happy. Something that they possess. Not a person, not an individual. And just like a child behaves when someone takes something they want, a narcissist behaves much like that when someone takes their former supply.
See, there's a theory that might explain everything, including the way narcissists behave in relationships, as well as how you fit into all of this. It's called attachment theory. Attachment is defined as a deep and enduring emotional bond that connects one person to another person. Attachment theory basically helps us to understand our relationships and how our relationships with our mothers could affect us and our lifelong development, and even our relationships with others in really profound ways. In psychology, attachment theory, as we know it today, was first originated in 1958 when psychiatrist John Bowlby recognized the importance of a child's relationship with their mother. It turns out, he realized that our emotional, social, and cognitive development are directly affected by our attachment to our mothers. Now, along with fellow researcher James Robertson, Bowlby found that children who were separated from their mothers would experience extreme distress. This would lead them to anxiety, and they assumed that this might have been related to the idea that their mothers fed and cared for them. But then they noticed that the separation anxiety would not diminish even when the kids were fed and cared for by other caregivers. Now, before this, the reason they thought this was because other researchers had sort of underestimated the bond between the child and the mother and assumed that the feeding of the infant was the thing that bonded the mother and the child. Well, Bowlby was the first to propose that attachment might be an evolutionary thing, as in, the child's caregiver is obviously the person who provides the child with safety, security, and food, so he thought being attached to the mother would increase a baby's chance of survival. Makes total sense to me. How about you? Now, if you are interested in learning more about attachment theory specifically, you can check out the links I'm going to leave for you in the description below. But I'm going to fill you in on what you need to know right now when it comes to dealing with a narcissist and what the attachment styles are. Speaking of which, what are the four attachment styles? Well, there are four primary attachment styles, like I said, including secure, anxious, preoccupied, dismissive, avoidant, and fearful avoidant, though there are some subtypes that have been identified. But for today, we're going to focus on just the four main attachment styles, which, for the record, sort of explain why families tend to see generations of healthy or unhealthy relationships repeating, and why it's so important for those of us who have grown up with toxic parents to intentionally change our own lives so that our children, if we do have any, can do better than we did in the future. We can change the generational curse, so to speak. So first, we're going to talk about secure attachment style. The secure attachment style is probably, if we're being honest, the most desirable one. It is where you feel comfortable and you feel connected to the person you're in a relationship with, and where you trust them and you trust the integrity of the relationship. Basically, you feel secure in the relationship. Now, people who have this style of attachment probably grew up with healthy relationships with their parents, and they also felt secure enough in those relationships to explore the world and other people in it. They felt loved and supported in childhood. This helped those people grow up feeling safe to involve themselves in a variety of situations and activities, knowing that they could still always go home and get support and love from their parents. And their parents were likely also securely attached to their own parents, so this healthy pattern would continue through to the next generation. Good stuff, right? So that's ideal. But then there's the anxious, preoccupied attachment style. If you've ever met a hopeless romantic, you may have been talking to someone who had the anxious, preoccupied style. This person desperately wants to be connected to others. They crave the emotional intimacy that comes along with relationships. The only problem is that this person also has this idea that they want to jump ahead in the game, even if their partner's not ready for it. So they're likely to say, "I love you," a little too quickly, and they might push ahead in the relationship even when there are red flags everywhere. They need constant approval and they need reassurance from their partners. They feel anxious if they don't get those things, and they doubt their self-worth, probably because they need others to validate them. And when their sort of clingy behavior pushes away their partners, well, they might feel like they were right all along, as in maybe they really are worthless. They have a positive opinion of people around them, their peers, but not so much of themselves. Now, these people's parents may have intermittently met their needs, as in they were loved and cared for, but not on a consistent and predictable basis. Interestingly enough, this kind of person develops when their parent seems to need the child to meet their own emotional needs. So their mother might have been the type that thought to herself, "Well, nobody loves me, but if I have a baby, at least I'll have someone to love me." It doesn't work that way, but once again, you can see exactly how this might carry on throughout the generations. This brings me to the dismissive, avoidant attachment style. This is where you might actually find a narcissist. Someone with a dismissive, avoidant attachment style certainly appears to be emotionally independent and is likely often a little bit afraid of committing to a relationship with a single person long term. So they have commitment issues, right? They would have had parents who were either not around a lot or were negligent in their care in other ways. They might have been ignored or abandoned or undervalued in childhood. They felt rejected. They felt not good enough, they felt unwanted, and one or both parents might have been completely absent for this person. Their needs may have been partially served, but not fully. For example, maybe they got plenty of food and they were bathed on a regular basis, they had clean clothes, but nobody held them, or at least not often enough. They might also have been rejected by their peers as they got older, and they might have lived their lives feeling just not good enough entirely. This would leave them afraid to trust people in general, and as a result, they might be really likely to be dismissive of other people. They tend to cover up their insecurity with a sort of false sense of self-confidence. But when someone is dismissive, avoidant, and they manage to find a secure, loving relationship, and they take the time to work through their own issues, well, they actually can manage to have healthy relationships. But unfortunately, for most narcissists, they don't develop the emotional maturity to do that, and they stay stuck in that attachment style. Let's talk about the fearful, avoidant attachment style. Now, this person, they might always be dating the wrong people for them. And on the flip side, they might also end up rejecting people who might be a really great fit for them. It's kind of an interesting thing. They might find themselves feeling kind of normal in unhealthy relationships, where they feel the need to earn the other person's approval. And they feel scared or they feel threatened when something seems too good to be true, or when things are going toward a bigger commitment like marriage. This person's attachment style might lead them to actually sabotage a really good relationship in some cases, maybe because they are afraid it will end, and it might leave them feeling devastated. They struggle with jealousy and with distrust in relationships, even when it isn't warranted. This person probably grew up with parents who made it really clear that they were either unwanted or that they were not acceptable as they were. They can sort of be like a walking conundrum. They desperately want emotional intimacy, but they also push it away. They want to be in a committed relationship with the right person. They actively seek out the opposite, or they avoid relationships altogether out of a fear of straight up rejection. Now, psychologists say that this kind of attachment style can be kind of a combination of the dismissive avoidant and the anxious preoccupied attachment styles. They also say that it's a result of dealing with a lot of trauma or loss in childhood. Like the dismissive avoidant, the parents of this person may have been unable to fully meet their needs in infancy. They may have always, for example, been fed enough and wearing a clean diaper, but maybe they weren't held or interacted with enough, for example. They might also find themselves having really difficult relationships with their parents, or they might even become completely estranged from them in adulthood, as in no contact. Their parents may have been alcoholics or addicts or narcissists, and they may have been physically and or emotionally abused. Now, which attachment style is yours? Let's talk about it. You personally might have any of these attachment styles, and you still could end up dealing with a narcissist. But those of us who end up in longer-term relationships with toxic people, well, we're most likely to fall into either the anxious preoccupied or the fearful avoidant attachment styles. Now, if you have an anxious attachment style, you're going to find yourself completely bowled over by a narcissist. And that's because you might tend to have high anxiety responses to their behavior. Just think about it. If you have the anxious attachment style, well, then you're also going to have a tendency to be sort of emotionally hungry, if you get my drift. You might find yourself holding on to the idea of being deeply bonded with someone else, even when it's just a fantasy and not reality in your relationships. What I mean is that you might sort of self-invent a bond, or you might experience a trauma bond, but the bond that I'm talking about, your partner won't feel at the same time, and that's probably partially because of how you were not nurtured enough growing up, and you probably had at least one parent who didn't give you the love and the nurturing that you really needed as an infant. You've dealt with a lot of turbulence in your life, and you might have felt unloved or unwanted, so you might have a tendency to latch on and hold on for dear life when someone does show some kind of love for you. Now, narcissists will see this in you and they'll sense this, and that's why you become vulnerable to them, because they know how anxious you become. And that alone gives them the narcissistic supply that they need, which is why they see you as the perfect prey in a way. Since narcissists are known to have the avoidant attachment style, they can be relatively abusive, as you know, and they will always find faults in you. They will place blame on you, since some people with the avoidant attachment style can't take responsibility for their behavior. The more they do this, the more you become anxiety-ridden, and your bond with them will disappear if the vicious cycle keeps going. But the bond was never real to begin with. Let's talk about which attachment style the narcissist represents, shall we? As I mentioned earlier, while technically a narcissist might classify themselves under any of these categories, they're most typically identified as the dismissive avoidant attachment style, which is why they maintain a certain distance when it comes to their relationships and why they make you feel like you're unwanted or unneeded, even if they clearly depend on you completely for narcissistic supply and, well, anything else. The dismissive avoidance style leads to being overly self-reliant, or appearing to be that way, and downplaying the importance of relationships. But they're quite vulnerable when it comes to a big crisis, because they don't handle a crisis very well. Now, they may have a super inflated opinion of themselves, and they can be very critical and suspicious of other people, which makes their relationships pretty miserable for anyone involved. Now, this is where you're going to find the overt narcissist, or the more kind of in-your-face narcissist anyway. But the covert narcissist can actually fall into the avoidant fearful style, which seems a little counterintuitive since their victims can also fall into this category. So let's talk about the wild card attachment style, which is fearful avoidant. Many people who could be classified as codependent might fall into the fearful avoidant attachment style. As adults, fearful avoidant types might become overly dependent on their relationships. While they might have had similar experiences in childhood, the difference between whether someone becomes a narcissist or a more empathic type of codependent would depend on how they deal with their own childhood experience when they are the fearful avoidant type. In either case, those who could be classified as fearful avoidant, they tend to be absolutely terrified of rejection, and they are constantly dealing with inner conflict. They sometimes thrive on drama, and they are nearly always suffering from low self-esteem. They are definitely prone to anxiety when it comes to relationships, whether they're super clingy or they're constantly avoiding intimacy. So how is it that a codependent people pleaser could potentially fall into the same category as a covert narcissist? Well, it is the codependency factor. Both narcissists and their victims could be, according to psychologists, considered codependent because at its most basic level, codependency represents someone who has sort of lost themselves or never found it in the first place. Let's talk about the lost self in all of this. In other words, a codependent person has no connection to their innate self, or they've lost it if they had it before. Rather, probably due to being raised by toxic parents, they've learned to base their lives, as in their thinking and their behavior, around someone or something else outside of themselves. Now, this could be a person or a process or even a substance. For narcissists, the lack of connection to their true self can then lead to a connection with a sort of made-up self or an ideal self, the mask that we often talk about with narcissists wearing. In contrast, a people pleaser might find their identity in getting approval from other people instead, or they might at least find value in themselves in this way. Otherwise, they feel worthless. Interestingly enough, narcissists in general are also thought to be emotionally immature. Like I've said before, they tend to be emotional toddlers, right? That's because when an infant is cared for by its mother, it does not think about the mother's needs at all, and that's very normal. It's expected. Most people do start to develop this awareness of the needs or feelings of other people on at least a basic level by the age of 2 or 3. Now, narcissists, they never develop it fully. So in some cases, even people who had really attentive parents can become narcissists, especially when their parents did not actively teach them empathy. Not everyone thinks of that. So what does all this mean? Are you just doomed to a life of miserable relationships if you don't have the secure attachment style? Well, I've got a little hope for you. As someone who's gone through narcissistic abuse, you'll be thrilled to know that there's something called earned secure attachment. That is good news because there is hope for you yet. Like I've been telling you for years, it is possible to heal from narcissistic abuse and to create the life that you want. And studies confirm this, telling us that with intentional healing and focusing on creating the life that you want, you actually can develop something called earned secure attachment. At its most basic level, that means that you can sort of build a new attachment style that is healthier and better for you on every level. So in other words, it means you've done the work, you've managed to deal with and heal from any dysfunctional parenting or trauma you had growing up. Even better, you can do this at any age. Yeah, it's about taking the time to understand sort of where you came from and working to rewrite your story in the process.
Toxic relationships affect your brain just like a drug. It affects the same part of your brain. In fact, romantic love in general affects your brain that way, which is very difficult to understand, but it does affect the same part of the brain as addiction. We're biologically programmed to stick around. We've kind of talked about this before, but the evolutionary consequence of losing a potential mate is on a visceral level devastating to us. Now, obviously today we don't need to have a potential mate in order to survive in the world, but back in the caveman days, we did. It would be bad for us as a species if we didn't. On top of that, us humans are kind of hardwired to develop bonds to other humans. It's another survival urge. Add together your biological need to bond, along with that primal instinct to keep your mate, or to feel great distress if you don't, what do you have? It's like the toxic relationship is a drug. It's like if you don't get the drug, you have withdrawal symptoms. A lot like a crack addict might miss a fix. So how can you tell if you're being emotionally abused? It's a lot harder to prove. It's a lot harder to even point out, to be honest with you, because it's so subtle. But the truth is, as we know, it's just as destructive in so many ways as other forms of domestic abuse. According to the Domestic Abuse Project, it's considered domestic abuse if a person makes cruel, unfair comments to those people they love or their partner, if they emotionally attack you, and they do so in order to gain power and control over you. Some of the signs of emotional abuse can include swearing or screaming at you, as they do with narcissistic rage, repeatedly harassing you, interrogating you, degrading you, attacking your self-esteem or insulting you, name-calling, put-downs, ridicule, attacking your friends or your family and other people you care for, personally or otherwise, blaming you for everything that goes wrong, forcing you to do things that are degrading, like making you beg for money to buy food, criticizing your thoughts, your feelings, your beliefs, your opinions, your actions, being very jealous, jealous and acting out on that jealousy, treating you like you've done something wrong as a result of their own feelings, making you responsible for their feelings, telling you that you're sick or you're crazy and you need therapy, gaslighting. If you have a physical disability, using that against you or putting you down for your disabilities, blatantly ignoring and denying facts or making up facts that suit the person better in the moment, also part of the gaslighting process.
Having a broken heart, feeling like you don't have the strength to go on, is completely normal after a relationship with a narcissist. There are certain things that you can do to get through it. So going through a relationship with a narcissist is really difficult. The end of that relationship sometimes feels even more difficult. So how are you supposed to get through those initial days and even the days that follow where you're asking yourself, how am I going to survive this? Am I ever going to get through this? It's not just your standard broken heart when you're talking about a narcissist either. It's so much bigger than that. And yeah, it's really hard to deal with. But you know what? Getting through this part is really essential for you, for your life, and everything that it involves as you move forward. Yeah, a broken heart is going to take time to mend. Even more so if you're in the middle of changing literally everything about your life, which very often you are when you're going through ending a relationship with a narcissist, whether it's your spouse or your friend or your parent. There's always some brokenness that comes along with it. It's an emotional pain that is so bottomless that it literally can feel like a physical blow to yourself. It is physically painful. It is emotionally painful. And when you're in this place, all you really feel like you want is just for this deep, horrible pain to just go away. As much as I'd like to tell you that there's some magical cure for it, there really isn't. There's no band-aid that can just literally be ripped off for a broken heart. And it does sound a little cliche, but time always does help heal all wounds. It is going to be the most effective way to get through it. However, there are things you can do along the way to speed it up a little bit if you want to. Over time, if you did nothing, the pain would eventually stop. But between now and then, the tips I'm going to offer you today will help you to make the pain a little less painful. It might make a little difference in how you're feeling and help you to stop feeling so much pain and start feeling a little bit more peace. First, I'm going to share with you my initial answer, the answer I gave during my live stream this morning, so that you can see what I said kind of off the top of my head and without rehearsing and thinking about it too hard. So take a look.
David Srini is here. Hello, David. Says, hi, Angie. How did you find the strength to carry on, knowing how hard the road ahead would be? That's a great question. I didn't have a choice. In my case, I had a child. And I'm going to tell you something, you guys. I'm the one who left, mind you. And yet I was completely devastated by the end of my relationship with my ex-husband. I found the strength to carry on partially because of my child. But I was devastated. I couldn't eat for 3 weeks, and that's really unlike me. But I couldn't. I felt like a failure. I felt like a loser. I felt like, you know, I'd wasted my life with this person and et cetera, et cetera. And I had always had this idea in my head that I never wanted to get divorced, and I just had to, unless I wanted to be miserable for the rest of my life. So it was difficult for me. But what I did was I just sort of faked it till I made it. I felt like I didn't want to ruin my kid's life. I felt like I didn't want to ruin everybody else's life. So I cried for 3 weeks. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't talk. I couldn't eat. And then I was like, okay, this is it. I got to get over it. I got to move on. I have to live now. And, you know, 3 weeks may or may not have been enough time. I could barely do anything else. So I carried on because I had to carry on. I carried on because it was what I needed to do. And I'm not saying that, you know, if you don't have a child, you don't have a reason to carry on. But for me, that was the thing that poked me to make me get over it quicker. And I wasn't over it. And I still felt a lot of pain and sadness about it. But I had to go about the business of life. I had no choice. And neither do any of us. We have to go about the business of life. And so if we choose to, you know, stew in it forever and stop existing and just kind of, or stop living and start existing only, then we need to put an end date on that. And that's something that I did without even knowing what I was doing. But it's something I've worked with several of my clients on, and it really does work. If you give yourself a certain amount of time to go through the morning and to be sad and scream and throw and break things and be angry and all those things, when you get to the place where it's time, okay, well, now it's Monday tomorrow. So now tomorrow I'm not going to be in mourning anymore. I'm not going to be grieving anymore. I have to start living tomorrow. You do, even if you have to fake it a little bit at first. You find the strength by digging deep and just knowing, okay, I have two choices. I can just crumble and stay down, or, You know, I get knocked down, I get back up again, you know, and that's what you do. Find yourself a power playlist, make yourself a power playlist. I did that too. Music is huge. You know, some music that empowers you, that makes you feel strong and worthy and sexy and amazing, all those things, you know, find those things. For me, sometimes I'm not going to lie to you, it involves dirty rap.
Now that you've heard that, I'm going to share with you 4 tips to help you take your pain and handle it in a way that is the most effective way you can. If you take the time to listen to this video and really try some of these tips and really allow yourself the opportunity to breathe and move forward, I really think you're going to find yourself feeling happier and more peaceful more quickly. This is stuff that works, stuff I've worked with my clients through, and even more. Take a look.
Number 1, cry. You might feel awful for the first few weeks, depending on how emotional of a person you are, and you might feel like crying for days, and that's okay. Go ahead and do it. A significant change really has occurred in your life, and it's very painful. There's no way to expect that you will just feel a little sadness and be able to shut it off with a switch. It just isn't that simple. So allow yourself to grieve for your loss, but not for too long. Staying in the past for too long can only hurt you. Number 2, talk to someone close, or someone who's been there at least. Use the shoulder of someone who cares about you or who really understands, like a coach, a therapist, or a support group member, like in the Spanily. Take it out your feelings. This is a way to purify your soul by letting someone share your pain. Let them listen, let them comfort you and offer advice. You don't necessarily have to take that advice, but sharing this comfort can make you feel better. Make sure you only allow yourself to grieve and lean on someone for a little while, because you do need time to move forward. Number 3, distract yourself. Bring friends you care about back into your life. Maybe having that relationship was keeping you from spending time with your parents or your siblings. Maybe you hadn't talked to your best friend in weeks. Surround yourself with a support network. Getting things that need to be done around the house is also a great way to get lost in a project. Go to the gym, organize your closet, get out and take a walk. Distracting yourself is a great stepping stone to moving on with your life. Number 4, look toward the future. Forget the past. Once you've allowed yourself the indulgence of grieving for a part of your life that is now in the past, hey, look forward. There is a definite need to be able to start a new chapter in the book of your life. Now that you've come past the sadness and the anger, it's time for hope and renewal that will help you to move on. So take time out for yourself. Get to know yourself as a single individual instead of as part of a couple. Replenish your soul by becoming you again.
One more quick tip for you, something that I do with my clients, as I mentioned in that clip earlier, very often we do this thing where we kind of set an end date on our mourning. It's not to say that you actually stop feeling all the pain at that moment, but it's more about giving yourself a certain amount of time to go through the hardest parts of the grieving, to go through the parts of the grieving where you feel just devastated and miserable, like you can't get anywhere. And if you take that time, I recommend anywhere from a weekend to 3 weeks, 4 weeks at the most. 4 weeks would be for someone who has been in a relationship for 25, 35 years. A weekend might be for someone who's been in a relationship for a few months. Anywhere in between, whatever works best for you and with your schedule and your life, because you really can't stop living forever. Take some time, pick a day, end the pain, end the active mourning on that date. This doesn't mean that you can't feel sad about it in a year when something strikes your memory and triggers you back into sadness. But it does mean that this is going to be the time that you're going to actively mourn this person and this relationship and the person that you thought you were getting into or getting with when all of this started, and also the person that you used to be, because now you're not going to be that person anymore, no matter how hard you try, but you can become a new, better version of yourself. And that, my friend, can be a very beautiful thing.
If you need help and additional resources on figuring this out or getting through it, visit queenbeing.com. If you're hoping to leave the narcissist, go to queenbeing.com/plan and start planning your escape. You deserve better than this. Please don't forget.
Now it's time for the question of the day. And the question of the day is,
does this ring true for you? Have you been in a situation with a narcissist where you felt stuck and you couldn't leave? Are you there now?
Share your thoughts, share your ideas, and share your experiences in the comment section below, and let's talk about it. As always, thank you so much for being a part of my day and a part of my life. And hey, thanks for letting me be a part of yours. It really does mean a lot to me. Now, before I go, make sure you take a look at the videos I'm going to leave for you right there and right there. And while you're at it, hit the subscribe button right there so we can stay connected and continue on this healing journey together. I'll see you soon.